Hey, folks, you're listening to the free version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. You're getting just about 48 minutes of content, maybe 50 minutes. Well, guess what? There's a lot you're leaving on the table. You can get three times that amount of content, three times the in-depth interviews, three times the analysis of the news, and three times of my dulcet tones by becoming a member of our podcast. Just head over to ROFpodcast.com. We rely on your memberships to keep this show alive. This is the way that media is headed, folks. And particularly if you want to have a media that is not beholden to corporate interests, somehow, some way, we've got to make it work. And we rely on our members. So it's ROFpodcast.com. You can sign up for a monthly membership. You can sign up for an annual membership. You will get 3 hours of our radio program every week. And you can go back and listen to some amazing interviews by Bobby Kennedy, by Mike Papantonio, by myself over the years on Ring of Fire Radio, because you'll have full access to our archives. Go over there, check it out, ROFpodcast.com. Thanks so much for your support. Enjoy today's show. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Today on Ring of Fire Radio, former attorney and contributor to The Nation magazine, Jessica Pishko, will join us to discuss how prosecutors are banding together to prevent criminal justice reform. Tarbell.org founder Wendell Potter will be here to tell us why Donald Trump hates Michael Moore and how he used to hate him too. Heather Digby Parton from Salon will be here to run down the most important news stories from this past week. And John Nichols from The Nation magazine will be here to explain how Trump's FCC chair is making moves to undermine journalism and our democracy. Don't forget, you can go to ROFpodcast.com and sign up for the free one-hour version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. And if you want the full program without commercials, become a member. That's the best way to support this show. That's ROFpodcast.com. Here to help me run down some of the biggest headlines of the week, Heather Parton from Salon, or as you may know her from her blog, Hullabaloo, Digby. So Digby, obviously a lot in the news this week in regards to Donald Trump and the Mueller investigation. But first, let's talk about what took place in New York on, I guess it was the night of the Halloween. It definitely was the night of Halloween. Probably mid-afternoon, a driver plowed a pickup truck through a crowded, basically, bike path on the west side of Manhattan, killing 8 people, injuring 11. He was ultimately shot by a police officer and is in the hospital now. It appears like he was... I don't know this for sure, but it appears going out with fake guns, essentially, is what he was walking around with after his truck crashed, would lead one to believe that he wanted to be shot to death by the police. But he was not. He has claimed this as a terror attack. He has, prior to being captured, he had left a note in his car to the effect of this was in support of ISIS. Apparently, you know, the mode in which he performed this terrorist attack was one that is promulgated by ISIS online in videos. Clearly a terrorist attack. But at the same time, we were talking before we went on air. You made the point that it's very hard to distinguish all of the implications, frankly, of this attack from the one in Las Vegas, except for the one in Las Vegas, ended up killing twice as many, almost three times as many people and injuring literally 50 times more people. I think this is an important point to make, because there is no evidence and no assertion that he in any way got material support from ISIS or some type of international terrorist or organization. The only thing he got was, you know, basically a functional, like, this is a way of doing it. And it's not terribly technical either.
Well, no. I mean, and besides which, I mean, you and I, without ever looking at an ISIS video, could take the
right.
same, you know, the same lesson. I mean, they've been doing this all over the world. It doesn't take a genius to figure out that, gee, I could do that too if you were inclined to do something like that. You don't need to be looking at ISIS videos to figure that much out. And I mean, this is what this always, I'm always just so frustrated by the idea, you know, mass killings. We have an epidemic of these things happening in this country, and it happens from guns, and it has now happens in this regard. They're motivated by any number of different things. And this guy, you know, unlike, and I'm making a distinction here between these, you know, what the FBI calls lone wolf terrorists, and people who actually go to Saudi Arabia to train, you know, or wherever,
right.
you know, go to ISIS territory and train with ISIS and become indoctrinated and set off suicide bombs. I mean, if you look at the people, for instance, in Paris, that was a different kind of terrorist attack. This thing, you know, in this country, we have crazy people killing people in massive numbers by different means, usually guns, but we also are seeing it done in this respect, with this method as well. And the idea that somehow or another one is so different from the other, based purely on the fact that the person happens to be a Muslim who claims that's the voice in his head that's telling him what to do, right, basically, I find it so frustrating. I mean, you had Donald Trump come out the day after Halloween and start talking about sending this guy to get, you know, they asked, would you send him to Guantanamo? Oh, yeah, and how he's going to change the visa requirements. And he was blaming Chuck Schumer because Schumer voted for the bill back in the 90s that allowed this people such as this guy to come into the country in some lottery. This fellow was not from the Middle East. He's a Muslim, but he's from Uzbekistan. So they launch into this big, you know, everybody's Fox News is all over it. They've got Pamela Geller on, you know, ranting and raving about Islam and how we have to keep them out, as if that's the issue here. You know, I mean, that's just like it's an incredible misdirection, it seems to me. And, you know, I'm not saying that there isn't such a thing as international terrorism or that this isn't something that people and the law and everyone else should be concerned with. But essentially, this guy, you know, he ran around, he had toy guns, which, as you point out, was probably a ploy for suicide by cop, right? Or at the very
right.
least, it means he was dumb as a, you know, doorknob. He goes to the hospital and starts bragging about doing it. Clearly, the man has issues, right? I mean, we've got something happening in the man's head. No different in that regard from all the hand-wringing we heard about the guy in Vegas, who,
right.
we don't know what prompted him to do that, but they certainly raced to find the mental illness excuse for it because he wasn't a Muslim. And, you know, so, oh, it must be that he's crazy. And this, you know, they're all crazy, Sam. They're all crazy. I mean, these people who commit these mass murders like this are all crazy. Now, they might be malevolent, evil as well. I'm not going to say they aren't. They might be criminals. They have all kinds of you know, crazy reasons. But this is, it's not really that different. And yet, of course, we treat them completely different, and it plays right into the hands of our, you know, tyrannical, would-be authoritarian freak of a president who decides that, you know, he's
right.
going to start, you know, basically clamping down on anybody with a beard, which means that, you know, the entire baseball, everybody who plays baseball is going to be thrown in Gitmo.
Right. I mean, and we've got to take a break here in just a moment. But the point is, and I think we can touch on this a little bit when we come back, because I think this is an important point to make. But the point is not just assessing. I mean, the reason why we assess why a person commits an atrocity like this, you want to call it a terrorist attack, call it a terrorist attack. I think, you know, you could argue that both were terror attacks in Vegas and in here. But the reason why we assess that is not the first order of business. It is the second order of business. Because the first order, the reason why we ask these questions is how do we prevent it or how do we mitigate it in the future? And coming up with and labeling this guy a terrorist of the equivalence of someone who is actually trained with ISIS or is getting material support from ISIS or some other terrorist organization or, you know, a domestic terrorist organization defeats the purpose of attempting to address that first order problem, which is
exactly
how do we stop it in the future. But we got to take a quick break. We'll talk more about this when we return. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio. I'm talking to the great Heather Parton, or Digby.
There comes a time, a time in everyone's life, where loving seems to go away, where loving seems to turn out right.
Hey folks, Mike Papantonio's new book entitled Law and Vengeance, which is the follow-up to his critically acclaimed novel Law and Disorder, is finally out and available to you to buy. The book is a legal and political thriller drawing on Papp's experience both as a skilled trial lawyer and as a nationally syndicated political talk show host. The story follows trial lawyer Gina Romano, who was first introduced in Law and Disorder, on her quest for both vengeance and justice in a whistleblower lawsuit against a weapons manufacturer who developed and sold a dangerously defective rifle scope. Papp has built a story around real-life events that he's encountered as one of the top trial lawyers in America, where he's been fighting some of the world's largest and most corrupt corporations. Buy Mike Papantonio's new book, Law and Vengeance, today. Go to www.lawandvengeance.com. That's lawandvengeance.com. Check it out. I know you're going to love it.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder, here with Heather Digby Parton from Salon.
So, Heather, when we broke, we were talking, obviously, about the terror attack in New York City this week. A man drove a rented pickup truck from Home Depot, basically drove off the street onto on the west side of Manhattan. There is a large bike and pedestrian lane, if you will, about the size of a small road. And he drove down that several blocks and killed 8 people, injuring 11. 5 of those 8 were visitors from Argentina who were having a high school reunion of sorts. And we were just talking about in the last segment that the difference between this attack and the attack we saw in Las Vegas by a, you know, middle-aged white guy who killed almost 3 times as many people and injured almost 50 times as many people is really the differences are nominal at best, because even if we were to know the intentions of the Las Vegas shooter, and we certainly know the intentions, or I should say the motivating factor that at least this terrorist in New York cited, which was his support for ISIS. But both of these guys were clearly insane. Neither of them, as far as we know at this point, got any material support from anyone else. They certainly, neither one of them had any connections to international terror other than citing it in one instance. We don't know why the Las Vegas guy did it. And if he had said it was, you know, to help the Catalans, you know, get independence from Spain, it certainly wouldn't be any more really remotely involved in that, what's going on there, than this guy saying, I've seen ISIS on YouTube and I support their cause. Because what's important is for society ultimately is
How do we prevent these type of attacks in the future, or how do we mitigate the lethality of these attacks? Now, in Vegas, it's pretty simple to contemplate how you might prevent the lethality of that attack, and that is you limit access to guns. We can't necessarily do that because of our political situation, but that would be a pretty good one. In this instance, you could limit people's access to cars, I guess, but that's a little bit difficult. But you could do a better job of making sure that cars can't get onto that roadway, which is actually the case in a lot of respects. But maybe we'll do a little bit better. We certainly have barriers like that around New York. But beyond that, to call this a terror attack or it's somehow unique from that attack in Las Vegas does not help us with the fundamental reason why we ask these questions, which is how do we prevent or mitigate these things in the future?
Well, that's exactly right. And I'll just point out, I was actually witness, or I was very close by, a very similar situation in Santa Monica years ago, and it wasn't maybe a decade ago, I can't remember, it was a while back. A man crashed into the Santa Monica Farmers Market and killed 12 people and injured over 60 by, you know, he hit the gas and went right through the farmers market and actually mowed people down. I happened to be within a block or two of that event, and I heard the screaming, the wild, saw people running. I mean, I was there. I walked up to it and then immediately left because it was just bloody carnage everywhere. It was a horrifying thing. And that man, who was an elderly man who nobody actually knows, he went on trial and he was convicted of vehicular manslaughter. People saw him hit the gas. I mean, there was a lot of many witnesses that it appeared that he actually did this purposefully, okay? And he was convicted, and they ended up suspending his sentence because he was ill. He lived for several more years and died at the age of 94. And that was, just if you look at the actual events, it was very, very similar to what we saw on Halloween in New York. We don't know the motivation of him, but we do know that what you describe as, you know, how do you prevent these things, the Santa Monica Farmers Market set up a series of barriers and various ways that they now will prevent any car from ever being able to do that again. If you go there, you can see that. It's still free. I go there every week. It's still very nice, but at the edge of where the traffic is, you can no longer access that with a car. You would be stopped. And, you know, that's how they dealt with it. That, you know, it wasn't that we suddenly decided to take away the driver's licenses of everybody over the age of 70
right.
and say, that's it. You know, you're no longer allowed to drive a car. They went, okay, well, how can we best reasonably in a free society deal with this? Donald Trump would apparently, if that guy had been Muslim, would want to send him to Guantanamo. This is irrational behavior. And by dealing with it irrationally, we give them power. And we give this terrorist movement that's out there. They gain from this, from the overreaction, from the hysteria that ensues. This is exactly what they're going for. It makes no sense to do it, and you don't see them doing it in Europe to the same extent that we do. They have these. I mean, look at what's happened in England in the last year or so. I mean, they had
right.
some terrible terrorist attacks. And they were coordinated, and they did suicide bombs and everything, but they didn't react to it this way. And this idea, you know, the president and his people and Fox News and all of that, they go completely hysterical on these things, and it ends up making it worse. I mean, I think they actually encourage this behavior by acting this way.
I totally agree, and there's a large argument that some of our support for oppressive leadership in Uzbekistan is also sort of driving some
exactly.
of this in some way. I mean, so, this very rarely is about how do we stop this stuff, but more about how do we gain push an agenda that tends to be anti-Muslim, frankly.
Yep.
But all right, we have to take a break. We'll talk more in the next hour. Heather, if you'll stick with me, I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Just ahead, why Donald Trump hates Michael Moore and why our next guest used to hate him too. I'm Sam Seder. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio.
saw you down in the background.
Folks, the Ring of Fire is sponsored by JustCoffee.coop. That's JustCoffee.coop. If you like fair trade, delicious coffee, tea, or chocolate, head over to JustCoffee.coop, use the coupon code MAJORITY, and get 10% off. There's free shipping. You have no reason not to get this great coffee. It's a great outfit in Madison, Wisconsin, which supported the protests there. JustCoffee.coop. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder. This year, Donald Trump felt the need to tweet his disdain for Michael Moore. It's no secret that the thin-skinned president dislikes the documentary filmmaker, but our next guest has written about a run-in with the director of such films as Fahrenheit 9-1-1, Sicko, and Where to Invade Next that changed his life forever. Here to tell us the story is former healthcare executive and founder of Tarbell.org, Wendell Potter. So Wendell, let's talk about your piece in HuffPo. Michael Moore's show, one-man show on Broadway, has closed. President Trump attacked him, and it brought up an occasion for you to talk about. What is in some ways sort of your genesis story. I mean, you and I have been. I've been interviewing you for quite some time now, and. You are launching an organization to dig into corporate influence in our politics and our society and whatnot. Talk about the relationship that you had with Michael Moore back in the day.
I sure will. Michael Moore, and at the time he had no idea, but he played a key role in what has become my journey in recent years. I was on a spy mission flying from Philadelphia to Sacramento where his movie Sicko, his new movie at that time, was being screened for the first time in the U.S., and I needed to know what the movie was like, and in particular, how my company, Cigna, was being portrayed in the film. I didn't tell anyone associated with the film that I was doing that. I was able to score some tickets from a politician in California, and I wrote feverishly in a notebook in the back of the theater and called into my colleagues back in Philadelphia after that to let them know just how badly we were treated. But as I was watching that movie, I just realized that Michael Moore really got it right as he was portraying the health insurance business in this country. And I knew that I was going to have a hard time honestly trying to refute what was in that movie. And that led to a lot of soul searching and ultimately my making a decision to leave that job and try to earn a living in a more honest way. So a couple of years later, I apologized to Michael on air on a live television program because I felt that I needed to do that. And I wrote about the role that I played in trying to discredit him and discredit that movie and how sorry I was to have stooped to that kind of behavior. It was the opposite of what I had tried to do as a journalist in my first career, and I just was just so ashamed of what I was doing and disgusted that I made a decision at that moment to figure it out and see what else I could do.
There's so much about that story. It's just amazing and enlightening. I mean, I sort of feel like if somebody had said had written a story contemporaneously that the big insurance companies are sending spies to watch Sicko because they are so afraid that their secrets about just how sort of broken, I guess, their business model is and how sort of corrupt it is. If somebody had written that story that there were spies being sent there, I feel like those stories would all be dismissed as conspiracies, conspiracy theory. And in fact, I mean, have you ever become aware of whether or not other insurance companies did that same thing?
Well, you know, I'm not sure about other insurance companies for that particular screening, but it goes on all the time. And it's something that I want to reveal with Tarbell, how big corporations and special interests go about doing, quite frankly, their dirty tricks to try to preserve a profitable status quo. I know how it's done. Prior to my going to Sacramento, we as an industry, America's Health Insurance Plans is one of the big trade associations for health insurers. They actually sent a guy undercover, if you will, to Cannes, to the Cannes Film Festival, for the very first showing of the film, its premiere at that film festival. And he did something comparable. He wasn't there to give us a play-by-play about how each company was depicted in the play, which is why I went to Sacramento in the first place. But they sent a guy all the way to France just to see that. They were that afraid of Michael Moore and his movie and the influence it might have on public opinion. And they stop at nothing. They do everything to try to make sure that people believe certain things and to get people to vote in certain ways, often against their own best interest.
What was the fundamental part in Sicko that Michael Moore depicted when you're watching this, were you surprised at what he learned or was able to communicate about the insurance business in terms of the way that it deals with health insurance, that you were like, oi, this is you were surprised that he figured out, and that this was sort of this part we don't want in any way to be revealed?
Well, first of all, Michael Moore is, a masterful storyteller and does very good work with his documentaries, one of which, of course, won an Academy Award. And this one was nominated as well, too. What I found with this movie was that he had done his homework very, very well. And I learned later that he had fact checkers to make sure that his storytelling was accurate. I had gone into this thinking that it might be, or we first thought it might be, about the problem of the uninsured in this country, but it wasn't. It was about people who have insurance, who have private insurance, but are constantly battling with their insurance company to get the coverage that they're entitled to, that's in their benefit plans, but that for whatever reason, the insurance company says, no, we're not going to cover it. And I used to deal with those day in and day out, those kinds of cases. We call them high-profile cases. And I just got to the point that I couldn't do that anymore. I was always trying to spin it in a certain way, obviously from an industry perspective. What he did was kind of pull all these together. And it wasn't just about my company. It's about just about every company, including some of the nonprofit ones, too, who engage in these practices. And I thought it was just a really good job of pulling this together in ways that I hadn't seen the media do it. We've had, the one-off stories many, many times over the years, but no one really pulled it together to put it in this kind of context and in this kind of a picture, if you will. So I was just really impressed with how he did it, and certainly lived to regret the role that I played in trying to diminish its impact.
I want to know and get a sense of what kind of stories you're going to pursue on Tarbell. But first, let me ask you this. I mean, based upon on what you knew of the insurance industry at that time, and since then, and I know we've talked many times about the deficiencies, about the Patient Protection, the Affordable Care Act, give me a sense of to what extent, what were the most important reforms that the Affordable Care Act imposed that were, uncovered, that were that you were afraid would get communicated to the American public at that time? What reforms, what was addressed by the Affordable Care Act? And then maybe we can talk when we come back what wasn't, and your other stories, but.
Yeah, and I think among other things, and it was the reason I testified before Congress, because I think there were a number of things that had to be addressed, one of which was to curtail what was happening in terms of investors demanding that insurers spend less and less every year on care, paying claims. And that's why we had an important inclusion in that bill called the one that restricts or pertains to the medical loss ratio. It requires that insurance companies pay at least 80% of what we paying premiums on our medical care, and it was getting to the point that insurers were spending far, far less than that, and that was the trend. We also addressed, and the ACA addressed, some of the practices like refusing to pay for needed care and rescinding people's policies when they got sick. It's a common industry practice, particularly in the individual market. When someone was diagnosed with breast cancer, for example, there were many, many documented cases in which the insurance company, when they saw a bill for treatment, decided to look at the applications looking for ways to say that the applicant had not been forthcoming and to cancel the policy. One woman in particular said that she had just forgotten to mention that she'd been treated for acne, and they used that as an excuse to rescind her policy and not pay for her chemotherapy for breast cancer.
Wow. All right. Well, we got to take a break. When we come back, I want to hear more about what kind of stories you guys intend to pursue over at Tarbell, and get your sense of what has to happen next in the healthcare area, and whether anything will, because as far as I know, we could be looking at cuts based upon what the Republicans want to do with taxes. But in that perfect world. All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Wendell Potter from the soon-to-be live Tarbell.org. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours poring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America. Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
We're back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder. Right now I'm talking with former healthcare executive and founder of Tarbell.org, Wendell Potter. So, Wendell, in the last segment before we broke, you told us about your origination story on some level, when you had basically just became too sickened by what the industry that you were working for, the insurance company, the health insurance industry, was doing in terms of their business practices. And part of that I guess awakening, or maybe it wasn't so much of an awakening as it was the last straw, was being sent to spy on Michael Moore's presentation of his movie at the time, Sicko. And so now you're starting Tarbell.org. Tell me what is Tarbell?
Tarbell is a new nonprofit journalism organization that's going to be focusing on the big corporations and special interests that really have the power in this country. We are named after Ida Tarbell, a very important investigative reporter from the early 1900s, whose reporting led to the breakup of a huge monopoly, the Standard Oil Company. And what she was doing was looking at exactly what we're going to be looking at, the power that has been amassed by big corporations and special interests. That was often called the Gilded Age and the Golden Age of journalism because of the work that Ida Tarbell and some of her peers did at that time. We're in a similar Gilded Age in which, once again, we're seeing unbridled and unchecked corporate power. And it's been made even worse with some Supreme Court changes or decisions in recent years that just open the floodgate of corporate money into super PACs and to influence directions more directly. We're going to show readers and viewers, because we will be multimedia, how this happened and how it's happening and playing out in real time and what it means for our lawmakers, how they've gotten corrupted and have to be pretty much answerable to those big donors, not to the rest of us, and also connect the dots to show how we are affected by all this, whether we're talking about extraordinarily high drug prices, paying far more than anybody else in the world for medications, or for changes in their climate, to why students are now leaving college saddled with debt they probably in many cases can never pay off, never be able to buy a house. How do we get here and what can we do about it? And that last part is very important. We're going to be pointing to solutions. There are solutions to these problems and these issues. We're going to highlight those, and we're going to help people understand how they can get involved to make progressive change happen. So that's kind of it in a nutshell. We're going to be actually starting with some journalism during our current crowdfunding campaign at Tarbell.org. We'll be, in the coming days, starting a series of reports on one industry in particular.
Can you tell us what it is?
It's the pharmaceutical industry. You know, we thought, by the way, when Sicko was being filmed, that he might be going after the pharmaceutical industry. It turned out to be the insurance industry. But we do have a situation which the pharmaceutical industry is indisputably, I think, one of the most powerful, if not the most powerful, lobbies in Washington. They rarely lose a fight. During the Affordable Care Act debate, by the way, they spent a record amount on lobbying in 1 year. In American history, it wasn't the insurance companies, it was the pharmaceutical companies, because they wanted to make sure that there was nothing in the Affordable Care Act that really would cause them any financial pain, and it sure didn't. And it's been that way time and time again, and we are going to be pulling the curtains back to begin to show people how they do it, how they are able to get what they want just about every time in Washington. We'll also be down the road looking at how they do the same thing in state capitals.
And so are you looking at exclusively like the political influence? Are you looking at larger questions of things like antitrust? And I mean, you mentioned the Gilded Age, right? And this is the trust busting became rather important at that time. Are there other sort of like broad issue sets that when we start talking about policy prescriptions or sort of broad reforms that need to be, give me a sense of sort of broadly speaking the dynamic here. And I think maybe people are familiar with it, but there's an invirtuous circle, I guess. As these corporations get bigger and more powerful, they can influence government to allow them to get bigger and more powerful.
Oh, exactly right, and that's what happened during the Gilded Age, and it's what's happening right now. We'll be paying close attention to proposed mergers and acquisitions. One of the most recent ideas was merging for Aetna and CVS Caremark to merge, a huge insurance company and a huge PBM and drugstore chain. What will that do? And what has happened as health insurers have merged with each other and grown so large that they have such clout in Washington, not so much, quite frankly, at the local level in being able to reduce prices for customers. It's not their main concern anyway, despite what they say. But how has all this consolidation in that industry and others affected our healthcare system? And what does it mean for us going forward? We have the most expensive healthcare system in the world. We pay far more on a per capita basis than anybody else, certainly for prescription drugs, but for everything else as well. And one reason for that is because these big companies, whether we're talking about insurance companies or hospital chains or drug makers or medical device manufacturers, they spend a lot of money to protect a very, very profitable thing that's going well for them, and they don't want it to be disrupted. And they invest quite a bit of money, but the return on that investment, when you talk about political favor, is really quite good. They know that they can spend a certain amount of money on elections, on contributing to in key races, and they know which ones to target. Because I used to lead our political action committee giving, and they know how to deploy lobbyists and to reach the power brokers within Congress, within the House or the Senate or a state legislature. We're going to be exposing all that and showing how all this has created a system of crony capitalism and has led to very unfair anti-consumer practices across the board.
So, Wendell, we just got about 30 seconds left. Just give me a sense of how you're hoping to fund this and why it's important the way you're doing it.
We're starting out with a crowdfunding campaign because our goal is to be 100% reader funded as soon as we can get there. We obviously are accepting guests at this time from foundations as well, but we want to be answerable to no one but our readers. We will not accept advertising. So that's what we're doing while we're doing the crowdfunding. We want to be accountable only to the public, to those who read our journalism.
That's great. It is tarbell.org. Head over there, folks. I'm very excited, Wendell, to see the kind of journalism that you folks are going to be producing out of there, and I appreciate you coming on and telling us about it.
My pleasure. Thank you, Sam.
Wendell Potter is an author, former healthcare executive, and founder of tarbell.org, where you can head over if you want to get involved in that crowdfunding. When we come back, Heather Digby Parton will join us to help analyze more news from this crazy past week. That's just ahead. I'm Sam Seder. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Make sure you check out ROFpodcast.com to hear what you've been missing.